So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming out on the last Sunday in August. Summer is waning. So I have a Zen dialogue. We've been having rainy days in August. Kind of feels different after the last few years. So I have a rainy day Zen koan. The cool rainy days have been a respite from the hot, smoky wildfires of the last few years. Michael and I really appreciated that when we were on our camping trip out to Banff in Alberta the last couple weeks. Yeah, so here's sun's coming out, but I thought of this as a rainy day koan. So it goes like this. Jingqing, Master Jingqing, asked a monk, what sound is that outside the gate? And the monk said, the sound of raindrops. Jingqing said, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. And the monk said, what about you, teacher? Jingqing said, I almost don't lose myself. Then the monk asked, what is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself? Jingqing said, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. Say the whole thing definitely is difficult. So that's from the Blue Cliff Record, Case 46. And I'll come back to the koan. But ever since our sesshin in July, some of you were there, a number of you were there. We call it Mountains and Waters Sesshin, and it's at a retreat center between Squamish and Whistler. For 5 days, 4 days, we focused on the practice of sounds, of listening. And I keep doing it. It's a very meaningful practice to me. As I was preparing this talk, I could hear our fridge sounding a bit strained and overloud, getting old. I could hear the wall clock ticking. At 7 o'clock every morning, we hear what I call the dog breakfast. Across through the woods, past our backyard, and through a kind of wetland area, are some neighbors with a kennel. And the morning breakfast chorus of barking dogs changes daily as a different cast of dogs passes through as their owners go on holiday and come back. So one day you'll hear this big, deep bark, and another day you'll hear this yippy, yippy bark, and all those in between. And it can be easy to find the racket annoying, especially when the woman yells, quiet, and the dogs ignore her. And I'm truly glad they're not right next door. But they are a bit muted, by the trees. But if I listen to them as a kind of musical cacophony of a chorus of these voices, dog voices that swells and subsides, I can find it kind of curious and even amusing. And sometimes as we're falling asleep or later waking us up, we hear a barred owl right out in our backyard, really loud, going. And you know what barred owls, what their hoot is like? They go, who cooks for you? That's what the books, the field guides to birds tell you, they say. It's how you recognize them. But they don't just do that, they also do this just maniacal, cackling, crazy sounds. You would not think it was an owl, but they do. And they're really loud if they're right outside your house. They make you laugh. The coyotes have been quiet this summer. Last year, they were very near and startlingly loud. Just, you know, wake you up. And in the morning, there's still birdsong. Not so much as in the spring or early summer. And they're starting up later, right? It's getting light later. So there's this feeling of the season turning, depending on the birdsong. Recently, on our camping trip, just a couple of weeks ago, I had an opportunity to practice with sound that I will share with you. The first night we arrived in Banff National Park, we were a little late to get a campsite at the campground where we had stayed before. That's non-reservation, first come, first serve. So we continued on to another one, which the information center had told us there were still plenty of sites, only to find out that it was closed to tents because of bear activity. Mm-hmm. And all the other campgrounds were full, so we were stuck. So we ended up backtracking to Castle Mountain cabins, which were very near the first campground, and spending much more than we would typically spend in a pinch for a cheap motel. But it was pouring rain, and we were grateful to have shelter in the cabin. Now, the next morning, we got up early, went to the campground, and nabbed a site that someone else had just vacated. We set up camp, and we took off for a day hike along Bow Lake. You've probably heard of the Bow River, which runs through Calgary. From the lake, along the lake, then we followed the Bow River, which was a rushing glacial torrent, until we came to this big waterfall coming off a cliff right off the glacier. And so the sound of water accompanied us all the way, sometimes a little farther, a little closer, a little louder. You know, the texture of the sound of the water and then the waterfall coming closer and closer as we went was part of our hike. And then that night I had trouble sleeping. This has happened before. I'm not typically subject to insomnia once in a while, but it's not typical. But sometimes the first night in the mountains, after a long hike, I feel like I've had too much caffeine. And I'm not even a coffee drinker. It's just that wired feeling. I'd start to doze. I wasn't preoccupied with thoughts. Just couldn't drop off to sleep. And I'd start to doze, and then something would wake me. And it was primarily the CNR trains. The CNR trains run along the Bow River through the Bow Valley. And they were really close to this campground. And there was a crossing. And they're quite active at night, more so, I think, than the day. So I counted so that they'd go by at intervals, and I counted at least 7, and the approaching engine would blast its whistle. Long, long, short, short, long. Really, really loud. And then the train would rattle and rumble by. Long trains, long freight trains. And I'd doze off a little. And then 3 times in the course of the night, the same vehicle went by towing a really rattly trailer. And then there'd be another train. And then for a while it rained. And that was kind of, okay, rain. And then there'd be another train. And so it was quite a night. And then as soon as it got light, cars started coming around looking to grab a campsite as they were being vacated. It was kind of an all-night sound meditation. I basically kind of just accepted that I would not sleep and that I would drift and wake and drift and wake. As we were having breakfast, I noticed that the people across the road from us were vacating their site. And I convinced Michael to help me pull up our tent stakes and drag the tent with the sleeping bags inside across the road. Why? you might ask, because behind that campsite was a little creek with a little waterfall about this high. And I thought that it would provide just enough buffering to mute the trains. And then we headed out for an even longer day hike than the previous day. And despite my lack of sleep, once I got going, the rhythm of walking, you know, walking in the mountains, feeling the body get used, you know, kind of get stronger and the lungs expand to handle the altitude, and looking up at the craggy peaks draped in clouds. And then there were three different times there was a kind of a rain squall of just kind of gentle rain that was cooling and refreshing. Because it had been more rainy than a typical August, there was an amazing array of mushrooms, all shapes and colors of bizarre mushrooms, and of course beautiful wildflowers. And the sound, again, the sound of water all along some through that we were walking through Paradise Valley, along Paradise Creek, sometimes close, sometimes crossing it, sometimes distant, and then hearing a distant waterfall come closer and closer and closer until we arrived there. So that night, I slept soundly. If I began to wake up, I'd just turn my attention to the sound of that little waterfall. And in the morning, I asked Michael, were there just as many trains last night? Not that he knew exactly, but he said, yeah, there were trains all night. I did not hear them. I slept through them. But in the morning, I heard them again early. And I just marveled that those train whistles that had been so jarring, I didn't even hear. I slept through. So it was a great lesson in the nature of perception and mind and conditioning and circumstances and how fluid that is. So, what is the sound? What is that sound outside the gate? Jingqing asked the monk. The sound of raindrops, or a train whistle, or the dog's breakfast. Jingqing replies, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. So what does he mean? Another translation says, sentient beings have it backwards. In the Heart Sutra, there's the line, and we'll chant it on, after this, the line, far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. What are these inverted, upside down, backwards views? Well, they are our habitual refusal to see that what we think of as ourselves, as a separate entity, is actually a constantly a dynamic process, constantly changing, completely interdependent with everything. Everything throughout space and time. Now, how vast is that? But that is us, right? That's our being. And so we refuse to see that, you know. It's a little scary. What will happen to me if I see that? Whoa. And so we lose ourselves and follow after things. Another translation says, they don't see their own body and chase after things. We don't see the true nature of our own being, our body, mind. And we chase after what we believe we need to complete us, to make us feel whole and worthy. That person who is really annoying or harassing, we just really wish they would go away. And that person that we admire or find attractive, we wish they'd pay a little more attention to us and appreciate us, right? No, there's always the push-pull. The reaching or the pushing, reaching and the pushing. So maybe that monk realizes just how hard it is to let go of our inverted upside down views. So he asks the teacher, what about you? And Jing Qing replies, I almost don't lose myself. I love this answer. It's so beautifully simple, humble, and accurate. Who among us maintains a perfectly enlightened view all the time, surrounded by this world of samsara, of suffering? Maybe there are a few alive who come very, very close. But if we are to live as bodhisattvas in this world, you know, where we vow to awaken not just for our personal benefit, but for everyone, which is the nature of being anyway, that everything we do or don't do or don't say flows outward and affects others. So if we are to live as bodhisattvas, it's good that we remember how it feels to be deluded. It's good that we can sit and be awake in our delusion. This is how we can keep our hearts open to suffering beings. Because we know how it feels to be deluded, how it feels to suffer. But the monk is puzzled. He says, what do you mean you almost don't lose yourself? And his teacher replies, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. So he's saying, this is really beyond words. We try to express our experience of the sound outside the gate, but as soon as we do, it's partial. We haven't expressed the whole thing. Outside the gate, outside the tent, the kitchen window. But our words are fingers pointing to the moon, as the old Zen saying goes. Not the thing itself, not the fullness. What kind of raindrops? Are they gentle or pelting down or violent? Are they welcome or oppressive? You don't know if you just say sound of the raindrops. It's hard to say just this as it is, complete within the vastness of being. There's another short Zen dialogue that resonates with this one, I think. And it's between a different monk, and his teacher, Xuanzha, who was a Dharma brother to Jing Qing. So I think there might be some connection here. They were both students of the famous Zen master Shui Feng. This monk had just arrived at Xuanzha's monastery, and he introduced himself as in the formal way. And he said, I have just entered this monastery. Please show me where to enter the way. And Xuanzha asked him, do you hear the sound of the stream in the valley? Yes, said the monk. Enter there. Enter there, said Xuanzha. So here again is a Zen master using sound as a Dharma gate to open us out of our stuck places. Enter there, enter right now. This dog barking, this child's cry, this train whistle. Notice how each sound can be aversive or pleasurable or simply a sound, just a sound, with a unique quality arising and subsiding. Depending on conditions, our reaction to exactly the same sound will be different, right? Is the dog barking our beloved pet, delighted that you've come home? Right? Or the neighbor's dog barking when you're trying to work or sleep? Same sound. Is the child's cry a cry of surprise, delight, fear, or pain? Sometimes you actually can't tell. You know, if you hear the neighbor's child, you know, wait, is there a problem? And then you realize it's, you know, a scream playing in the pool, or you know, you can't tell. And how does our own conditioning affect how we hear it? How we hear the the cry of a child, for example. Now that I'm home, that same CNR train, when I hear the whistle faintly in the distance as it heads east along the Fraser River, is somehow evocative, a little bit mournful, you know, that distant train whistle. How the circumstances change the same sound. So as I talk about sounds, are you starting to notice how our perception of sounds and of other sensory information is similar to our perception of our own mind content? This is why listening practice is such a good template for seeing into the nature of mind. So what arises in your mind when you're sitting zazen? Memories, worries, plans, daydreams, they're just like sounds arising. All those inner dialogues that run through our minds arise and subside. Yeah? Just like that dog's breakfast, that noisy ruckus arises and subsides. And our reactions to them are subject to causes and conditions. They have no objective reality. So we don't need to cling to them to kind of reify our existence, to kind of shore up and reinforce our sense of self. We can relax our grip on that mind content and our reactions to it. So each koan, each of these stories or dialogues in the Blue Cliff Record is typically accompanied by a verse by Shwedo, Zen Master Shwedo, who first compiled this collection back in the 11th century, China. And then another Zen Master Yuan Wu added his commentary about 100 years later. And in the commentary, he tells us that Jing Qing used this same question with his other students, nudging them through the Dharma gate of sound. So he asked, what is that sound outside the gate? To a different monk who said, the sound of a quail. And Jing Qing said to him, if you wish to avoid uninterrupted hell, don't slander the wheel of the true Dharma of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is the Buddha. Don't slander the Dharma of the Buddha. It's a little fierce. And then another time he asked a different monk, what is the sound outside the gate? And that monk said, the sound of a snake eating a frog. I kind of wondered about the translation. Shouldn't it be the sound of a frog being eaten by a snake? I don't know. And his answer to that was, I knew that sentient beings suffer. Here is another suffering sentient being. So one answer seems very harsh, another seems very compassionate. But Yuan Wu in the commentary said these answers are equivalent to the one in the koan. We can't know what was in each monk's reply that elicited that, or each monk's manner that elicited that reply from the teacher. But in each case, he was asking them to enter the gate of sound and go beyond. Again, Yuan Wu, the commentator, says, if patch-robed monks can penetrate here, nothing can block their independence within the heaps of sound and form. If you can't penetrate, then you are constrained by sound and form. When he refers to heaps of sound and form, he's referring to what are called the five skandhas. They're called aggregates or heaps. And they are, in Buddhist thought, what make up our body-mind complex of consciousness. And they are form, sensations, perceptions, mental content, mental formations, and consciousness. And we don't need to worry about those exact definitions right now. But they are the ways that we apprehend the world around us, interact with the world around us, and the way that our body-mind is conditioned. The Heart Sutra tells us that the five skandhas are empty. And that means they don't have separate, substantial, permanent existence. They exist in dynamic interaction with each other. You know, so this wood and these knuckles and this sound making waves going into my ear and the neurons taking that information to my brain is a constantly shifting dynamic process, right? Those are the five skandhas. And then my brain labeling that sound and interpreting that action or that sound, that's what the skandhas are. That's how they function. And so when it says the five skandhas are empty, it means they don't have independent, fixed existence. Does that make sense? Emptiness is such a tough, you know, it's a word that throws us off a little bit, I think. Not the best translation, but we're kind of stuck with it. Boundlessness is another translation that's used, and I actually quite like that, boundlessness. Kaz Ta-Nehisi uses that word. And I think it expresses better what this is. So when we deeply understand the boundlessness of the five skandhas of our being, when we can live this understanding, when we experience it directly, then we're not constrained by our fixed views, our stuck places, our conditioned habit patterns. In his introduction to the koan, Yuan Wu says, "His slightest word can break things up, untying what is bound and releasing what is stuck. As if walking on thin ice or running over sword blades, he sits within the heaps of sound and form. He walks on top of sound and form." So he's describing the freedom of that unconstrained body-mind. And yet, of course, it's so easy to slip, right? To become hooked and snagged by our conditioned mind, our habit patterns, our reactions to all the many stimuli around us and within us. Maybe the ones within us are the hardest. And so we think, you know, that freedom is way, way out there after countless lifetimes of practice. You know, then we'd be perfectly enlightened. But actually, there are times when we are free, when we are completely present, and it may only be a moment, may only just be a moment, and that sense of separate self just drops away. In that moment, or in that short time, we are free. And often, we don't even know it, you know, because we are experiencing it. We're not patting ourselves on the back and saying, and as soon as we do, say, "Oh, wow, that was an experience." We're out of it. We've lost it. Right? So that's why some of the texts we have say there's a hair's breadth deviation, you know, between samsara and nirvana. They're right here, right together. So the verse that goes with this koan, written by Shwedo, goes like this. "An empty hall, the sound of raindrops. Hard to respond, even for an adept. If you say he's ever let the stream enter, as before, you still don't understand. Understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain, on North Mountain, more and more downpour." He uses the phrase entering the stream. And entering, being a stream enterer, is the traditional word for someone who just starts on the practice, who becomes aware that there's a need or an intention to wake up, and that's called the stream enterer. And I love that sense of the stream being our practice, you know, our path that we enter. The commentary to the poem, the verse, says, there's relative and absolute. There's letting go and gathering in. There's killing and bringing to life. There's catching and releasing. Relative means our daily life, the world of, you know, contrast, good and bad. The absolute is the world of boundless unity, right? And they're both simultaneous, right? All the letting go, the gathering in, the killing, bringing to life. There's catching and releasing. So that is how we awaken. We practice in the midst of the cacophony of life, the big mess. And we enter the Dharma gate of each moment. Even if that moment is our aversion, our frustration, we enter that. We catch our delusion and release it. Catch and release. The great 20th century Rinzai Zen master, Japanese Hakuin Yasutani Roshi, who came to the States and taught, wrote this poem. Just listening, body having no self, the raindrops falling from the eaves of the house, are nothing if not myself. The sound of the raindrops, the waterfall on the mountain, the train whistle, the dog's breakfast, nothing if not myself. The cries of sentient beings in pain or delight, nothing but yourself. That is the way a bodhisattva perceives the sounds of the world. Remember, Kanzeon Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva, or Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Kanzeon means hearing the cries of the world. So this is the way a beginner Bodhisattva enters the way, becomes a stream enterer, right here, right now, in this moment, entering the sound of the moment. So I hope you will enjoy practicing with listening to sounds, as I have been doing in these recent weeks. So thank you for listening to me for this little while. let's chant the closing chant together, back on page 3. May our intention